Okay. Yeah, my name is Roger Lang. I'm a patent attorney. I specialize in software and mechanical type things. I don't do any biological or chemical stuff. It's just not an area that I haven't, I just don't know anything about that, so I don't do that. Like I said, I'm here to talk to you about patent law and trade secret law. Those are things that I deal with. Trade secrets come up in patent law sometimes, and then I think we have trademark and copyright people up here as well. From a patent standpoint, basically, the United States recently became what was referred to as a first-to-file country, where what's now called a race jurisdiction. So whoever gets to the patent office first wins. There is no more first-to-invent and interference practice before the patent office, so that's not going to happen. So in that sense, you definitely want to try to file patent applications on any ideas you have before you make public disclosures. The United States still does allow certain latitude in terms of a one-year grace period from disclosures before filing, but you don't want to risk someone beating you to the patent office. Granted, they may not have actually invented, and you could probably challenge their patent based on inventorship, but if you have that kind of money, then why waste it? Generally, some people have a misunderstanding about patents. Patents do not give you the right to practice your invention. They give you the right to exclude others from making, manufacturing, importing, or offering for sale your patented product. So just because you have a patent on something doesn't mean you can do that thing. That's one of the things people hear about with trolls. Some people actually have a patent on something that they're doing, and then a troll comes along and says, even though you're, or excuse me, a non-practicing entity, if you want to be kind of correct. So just because you patent something doesn't mean you can do that thing. It means that you can just stop others from doing it, and that's where you have the troll problem that some people are viewing. What is and is not patentable, there is some flux in that right now. Some of the biological things, there is some things where certain parts of the human genome people have tried to patent. Excuse me. So there are different parts. There were some provisions in the American Invents Act that had to do with trying to patent a human being. You can't do that. And that actually comes up in, like, with medical devices. You'll see people, they'll claim a knee replacement where it's actually implanted in the person already. Well, then you're positively claiming a person. You can't do that. So that's one of the things that, you know, sometimes you'll see. Some of the software stuff, there's some recent Supreme Court cases, Alice versus CS Bank, that has to deal with whether or not something is an abstract idea. You can't patent that. Basically, you're allowed to patent things that are a useful process, machine, manufacturer, article, machine, manufacture process, or any improvements on those things. But there are certain judicial exceptions for things like an abstract idea. If you discovered gravity, you cannot go, or laws of nature, you can't patent gravity. If you were Newton, you couldn't get a patent on gravity in the United States. Now, if you can figure out something useful in a technological implementation of gravity, let's talk. Otherwise, you know, you just can't do that kind of thing. Trade secret comes up because some people want to keep their inventions a secret. They're like, well, we don't want to tell people how to do it. One of the things with a patent is that you have to explain what is the best mode of manufacturing, or the best mode of making or implementing your invention, along with, you don't have to spoon feed people, but you have to tell them enough so that they can manufacture or implement your idea without undue experimentation. Now, what's undue experimentation? If you're really unlucky, a judge will tell you that what it is. Most of the time, you can figure that out. With computer stuff, I don't have to provide you with source code. I just need to provide you a structure of how the program might work. Something that's mechanical, most mechanical people, you have a good set of drawings. I can tell you how to build something if I have a decent set of drawings. The written description, some mechanical inventions, you can look at the drawings and gain more than what the actual description says. Some people are just visual that way. But then sometimes people want to keep something a secret. Like, for example, most famous trade secret in the world, formula for Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, at one time, they probably could have patented the formula on how to make Coke. They can't do that anymore because they've been selling it for more than a year. There's some gray area in terms of, if I keep this process a secret, can I patent the product that it makes? There's some gray area in that, but for the most part, no. And trade secrets, if you want to protect those, it's just that. You have to keep people from discovering it. There's actually case law out there, and trade secret is usually covered under state law. I know in Georgia it is. There's actual trade secret statutes in Georgia. And you can't... You don't have to, like, be ridiculous with it. You don't need, like, a Fort Knox to protect your secret, but you have to take reasonable steps to protect it depending upon its value. Something like the formula for Coca-Cola is extremely valuable, and so they go through great efforts to protect it. There was actually evidence. We had a case where when Diet Coke first came out, there was a lawsuit between the distributors of Diet Coke and regular Coke because they were charging more for Diet Coke, and they said, well, you need to turn over the formula for both of the drinks, and then that way you can say, yes, Diet Coke is not Coke. Coke's like, no. And the judge is like, well, I'm going to say that they're the same, and you're going to lose. Like, okay, tell us how much is the check to write. So they wrote a check. And it's just a question. They're not going to release that. So, you know, yeah, you can get secrecy orders and stuff like that, but you don't have to do that. There's another case with DuPont. They were building a plant to have a process. The process was a trade secret. Somebody chartered an airplane, flew over the construction site multiple times and took pictures, because once you saw the different pieces in the plant, you could back out the process. And they're like, no, you can't expect them to build a building to house the process while they're building the building that houses the process. That doesn't make sense. So it's not unreasonable for them to have the thing exposed from the air. You can't just fly, you know, you can't go through these, you can't expect someone to do everything humanly possible to maintain a secret. You just have to take a reasonable steps. For example, if you own a company that manufactures certain parts, maybe these parts are proprietary inside the machine, and when someone actually buys the machine, they're under a lock. I think some copiers used to be that way. Then the drawings that are needed to produce those parts, okay, you don't have those just lying around the office. They're kept in a locked box, you know, something like that. So, and that's what you get in terms of trade secrets. Again, it's just what's considered reasonable to protect it. Depending upon the value of the secret, what may be considered reasonable may be a little more for you to implement. In terms of, like I say, with the patent law, the United States is generally a first to file. There are four basic requirements. You've got to have something that's new, non-obvious, useful, and it's got to fit within one of the statutory classes. If you meet those four things, you're probably going to get a patent. Most people think that the obviousness one would be pretty easy to get over, because if your invention is useful and new, it's probably not obvious. Obviousness is one of the hardest requirements to get over in the patent world, because the examiners combine references. They just go find the different pieces that they need and say, here's piece A, here's piece B, it's obvious to combine them, even though they're not even remotely related to one another. And you can get into a back and forth with that. Patent law is probably one of the more expensive forms of intellectual property law. A simple mechanical patent or an electrical type patent, you could be looking at anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000, and that's just to get your application filed with the patent office. That's not even a back and forth with them. It's simply to have it filed. Some of the chemical things I've seen applications where you're $25,000 just to get it filed. I mean, you're talking PhD level attorneys with, you know, PhDs in chemistry, biology, things like that, drafting the applications. Trade secret, again, it could be as simple as a $3 padlock from Walmart. It could be something as expensive as a vault at the Coca-Cola headquarters is buried underground, probably. So it's just a question of what it is you're trying to protect. So in that sense, trade secret could possibly be more expensive. But generally speaking, patents are considered one of the more expensive forms of intellectual property. Some people will say they'll give you greater protection than other forms of intellectual property. Pretty sure they might debate that with you. It's just a question of what it is. A lot of people have a misunderstanding of what something of what can and cannot be patentable. Again, an idea in and of itself is not patentable. Now, if you can produce that into some form of thing that fits into one of the statutory classes, sure, we can talk. A lot of people think that they have a logo, so they should get a patent on their logo. No, you don't get a. You use the same office at the government in Virginia, but it's not the same thing. A patent and a trademark are very different. What they provide is very different. Even their basis in the Constitution is very different. Patent law is founded in was Article 1, Section 8. It's specifically called out. Patent law encourages innovation. It's the idea is we'll give you a limited monopoly on whatever your invention is. In exchange, you're going to tell us how to use it so that once that monopoly's up, that product goes into the public domain and anybody is free to use it. If you want to, you can give it to the public domain ahead of time. You can just disclaim the invention. That's actually a common procedure. Some people do that. IBM is, I don't know if they still do it as much as they used to, but they, at one time, they would file disclosures with the patent office just so that they would publish and they could give it away. They didn't want other people to be able to do it, but they didn't want to do it either, so they're like, we'll just give this away. So very altruistic in that sense. IBM is also one of the largest patent holders out there. They hold the record. They usually get somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 patents a year. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's amazing what they've done. They're one of the few people I've ever heard of whose their intellectual property department is actually profitable. It's a profit center instead of a profit drain. Okay, so that's a quick overview on patent law. We'll let them speak, and then if you have specific questions about it, we can deal into that.
Okay, I think I'm next. Okay. I'm Courtney Lytle. I'm a practicing attorney here locally. I refer sometimes to myself as a recovering attorney. I'm no longer at the big firm, which is why I'm actually here this weekend rather than at my desk where I used to be on nice weekends. I mainly do academics these days. I still also have some clients who won't go away no matter how hard I try to get rid of them. I'm going to talk to you this morning a little bit about copyrights and trademarks. I'm going to hand it off to Meredith, who will tell you about some fan interface work that she does, and then we'll have time for y'all to have some questions. But we're going to give you the basic framework of the law. I'm sorry. We're going to give you the basic framework of the law, and then we will let y'all ask what you want to know. So you heard about patents. Patents are what the rest of us think of as the smart people law, because you have to do math and science to be a patent lawyer. You actually have to take a separate test and have taken real science classes. My science class was astronomy. There was a reason for that. I'm not smart enough to do patent law. Copyright and trademarks, way easier. You have to take a separate test to do that stuff. Any moron can do copyright and trademark law. Like me!
Thank you.
Sorry, Mary. No offense, dear. And some very smart people, too. But to distinguish between the three main areas, patents are your science things, your inventions, like Roger was talking about. Your formulas could be either way. Coke is your trade secret. Colonel Sanders' 11 herbs and spices, those are also a big famous trade secret. Those, again, are more invention things, but trade secrets can be anything. Patents, as Roger said, had to be within the statutory limits. Trademark, we'll start with next. Trademark, look, here's one. Mountain Dew. Anything that can identify the source of a good or a service is a trademark. These are your brand names. These are your slogans. These are your logos. It can be color, not any color. It has to be color that's non-functional, because trademarks have to be non-functional. Think about trademark as a Consumer Protection Act. Copyright and patent are more about protecting inventions and art to encourage the production of inventions and art. That's why it's in the Constitution. The Founding Fathers noticed that we had just done away with the aristocracy and a government-led church, and in the past, that was who paid for all the art and music and books. So we needed something, and they said, hey, you know what we've got? We've got a market. So we want to protect the inventions and the art, and so we'll grant a monopoly to the inventor or to the artist. So copyright is a government monopoly over whatever you've produced. Patent, same thing, but it's smarter people who've produced things that are useful. Trademark is a Consumer Protection Act, basically. It's so when you pick up that red can with a swoosh, you know what's inside it, and you know where it's from. If you see something with a big DragonCon logo, you know where it's from and what it is. It's so you're not going to the supermarket saying, well, that says Coca-Cola on it. I wonder if it is. It's protecting you guys. Companies like to think that it's protecting them and giving them the rights over their goodwill and their trademarks and all of those things, but it's really about you guys. There's not much that is. Trademark is. It's all about you. So that when you buy something, you know what you're getting. Unlike patents and copyrights, trademarks can last forever. I guess the clever thing to say is, unlike love, trademarks are forever, but I'm not quite that cynical. So trademarks can last for the company as long as they use them. Coca-Cola runs the risk that many other companies have fallen into of their name becoming generic, which I'll get to in a sec, but as long as you keep using your brand, your trademark will continue. That's why every now and again you see random companies bringing back old logos and old pictures and stuff. I assume that's why KFC has brought out that awful revamped version of the Colonel, because they have to trot him out often enough to not lose that trademark. It's kind of a use or lose thing. As long as you're using it so the public identifies that with your goods or your services, you get to keep it. If you stop using it, you lose it. And so I, when I first saw that really kind of creepy guy that sort of looks like Colonel Sanders in those new commercials, I assumed that was a trademark thing. Most people probably assume it's a marketing thing, but you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To me, it looked like a trademark problem. So as long as you keep using it, you got it. Patents, as Roger pointed out, are incredibly expensive and difficult to file. You cannot file your own patent. Well, you can, but
legally you can.
You can, but it won't work. You can file whatever you want. You will not end up with a patent. That's just how it works. Lawyers like to perpetuate their own employment, and the patent office is staffed with lawyers, so you got to be one really to get through the hoops. Trademark, you can do yourself. It is a little more complicated. There'll be parts of the online application that you don't understand. The neat thing is your tax dollars at work pay for some lovely reference attorneys. You cannot ask them a question about the law or how you should do something because they're not your lawyer. But they're incredibly helpful when you say, okay, it says I need an ICC class. What is an ICC class and where do I find it? Now, actually, that's in the FAQs. Look there first. But if you're confused about filling out the form and you don't know what to do, they're actually stunningly helpful. There are a few of them who are jerks. If you get one of them, thank them, hang up, call back. You'll get someone else. And they're really helpful. So if you wanted to try to file your own trademark, you could. You would probably get a better result with an experienced attorney, but a trademark is doable by yourself. You don't necessarily have to pay a trademark lawyer usurious amounts of money per hour to do it for you. Especially since they'd probably palm it off in a paralegal. But it's one that you can do. Depends how much you care about doing it right. How you write the trademark application is going to determine what it covers exactly. So if you care enough to file a trademark, you probably ought to consult an attorney. But again, money matters. And if you can't, you can do a trademark by yourself. It will just cause you a little bit of pain and suffering. Think about that, about what we do every day, all day, when you're beating your head against the wall. Yeah?
Yeah, you have to also be careful. If you file for a trademark and you fail, that image or that item may not be trademarkable after that.
Oh, they'll remember you, yeah. Once they turn you down, they know.
Yeah.
And they will go back and say, oh, that's cute, you're filing again. Guess what? The answer is still no. You will get strange results, though. I filed a series of trademarks for a client of mine who made, of all sexy things, spray foam insulation. Yeah. But it's two chemicals that you spray together and they make that hard stuff in between your walls, if you're lucky and have a well-insulated house. The first couple times we filed it, we were in a certain construction and chemical class. Then I filed a couple others a year later, so we got a different examiner. And they made us file in two different classes and wouldn't let us file in the classes that the exact same product was in a year earlier. We said, but we're these people. We're the same people, and it's the same thing. And the examiner said, no, you can't file in the two classes that the rest of your trademarks are in. You have to file in these other classes that are different chemical and different construction classes. If you come up with a new product, it's even more fun. They've gotten better, especially about things like your online, like the picture of the specimen. You have to give them a picture of your label, basically. That's fun when there's a requirement that you show a picture of the physical product, and you have a piece of you're basically selling software that you download, and there's nothing physical anywhere. I don't know if it's completely ethical to mock up a box and take a picture of it, but I have heard that can work. But sometimes you hit stupid foul-ups with them. They're getting better. If you have a really novel, clever little social service, I represented a guy that did, I don't think it's even around anymore, the rejection hotline. It was, anyone heard of that?
Yeah.
People have. It's kind of, it's still there? Sweet. Jeff's still working. Any rate, it's a basically a phone number. If you're at a bar and someone's hitting on you, you can say, okay, here's my number. And they call it up and they get a fairly insulting and snarky message going, ha ha ha, you're a loser. She didn't want to talk to you. Yeah. Well,
that's
okay.
Hilarious.
That's not really telecommunications, but it is using telecommunications, so they didn't think it was really entertainment. So you may have to negotiate with the guys if you're doing something unusual. So if you have something new, which when we filed that was new, you might, again, want to talk to an attorney to get some advice about what class. But trademarks, you can kind of handle. And again, think of trademarks as your brands. If you're talking about celebrities, you can sometimes trademark a celebrity name, but usually that's under privacy and right of publicity laws. Gets a little dicey in between. Sometimes you can trademark your name, but only if it is associated with a good and service. Where that line is, you know when the trademark office tells you. But if you're trying to do a name, that's more of privacy rights and publicity rights. That's state law, and you'll have to figure out the ins and outs of it. The bottom line is you can't use someone else's name or likeness without their permission, but that's not usually trademark. Sometimes it is. That's trademark. Copyright is the books and the art and the music and the performances, all of the creative stuff. Patents, the science stuff, trademarks, the brand stuff, copyrights, the artsy stuff. Just like with patents and copyright, you cannot copyright an idea. It has to be a tangible expression of that idea. My very detailed notes here, this is covered by federal copyright because I wrote it down and it's fixed in a tangible medium. An archaic tangible medium that I like because I am that old. But I don't need a web connection to read my notes. The nice thing about copyright is as soon as you write it down or otherwise fix it in a tangible medium, you have federal protection. So no, I did not actually mail a copy of this into Washington and copyright it because I'm not quite that desperate. But, and honestly, if you guys want my notes, you can have them. Just a sec, let me get through this little piece of it and then I'll come to you. You may have to remind me. So copyright, the new law, new being since 1978, by the way, 1978 is when the new Copyright Act went into effect. It is called the 76 Act. It's the 1976 Act. It went into effect January 1, 1978. Congress. Under that law, anything you create and fix in a tangible medium is covered automatically by copyright law. You do not have to file anything ever. Your stuff is protected when you make it. However, if it's something you actually care about, if this is the novel you have written, or the painting that you have worked on, a collection of photographs that you want to exploit for commercial gain, something you actually care about, file it. You are protected without filing, but if it's something that matters, go file it. You're protected better. And filing is easy. I said with trademark it's going to be painful, but you can do it. Copyright, honestly, God, is simple. If you pay a lawyer to file a copyright for you, you're a moron. I'll do it for you. I'll charge you a bunch of money to do it. It'll take me a few minutes. It'll take you a few more minutes than me because I know which buttons to click. But honestly, it's not hard. You can, and you end up sending a copy of your work, and it tells you how to do the copy. If it's a huge sculpture, you don't have to make a little one. You can send a photograph. And if you really want to, if you've published your novel, you wouldn't care. But if you've written your novel and were wishing you had published your novel, file it for a copyright, because then you send a copy of your novel to the Library of Congress, where they keep a copy of it. So you can tell people your novel is in the Library of Congress's permanent collection. And that sounds really impressive, unless they know why it's there.
I think it costs $60. To fill out to mail in a copyright application.
It was really 35 cheap. Last time I did it.
No, they raised it.
Did they raise it?
Yeah.
It's been a while since I filed.
Inflation hit.
Trademark is 350 per class. If you have to do multiple classes, it's 350 per class. Copyright is apparently 60 now. Last time I did it was 35, but still, it's not a huge financial burden. If people always ask me, if I'm a photographer, do I have to pay $60 per photo? You can compile your photos together into one work and give them a chunk of photos and pay one $60 fee. You don't have to do 60 per photo. There was something else I was about to say, but let's go to the question while I figure it out.
Yes. This is cool, by the way. So about a year and a half ago, I did a copyright for a script for a web series I was hosting, and I figured out, okay, so there's a new medium for doing stuff like web content. You still copyright it like a TV show, but what if you want to copyright the storyline as a whole? What is the difference between doing just the pilot for the one episode, or would I have to copyright every single episode I make? Could I just copyright the storyline and I'm fine?
Well, it depends what you're trying to protect. If you have a script, you're protecting the script. No one else can make a movie out of it because that would be a derivative work. If you want to protect the images from your movie, file the film. What you file is what's protected, but no one else can take it and work around it except for fair use, which we'll also talk about in a minute. But let me finish up the copyright thing and let Meredith do her piece, and then we can get to the individual questions. If you have something like right on point with, wait, you said something and it makes no sense, we'll do those now, but I promise, we're leaving time for all of y'all to ask those questions after the fact. So if you have a what the hell did you just mean question, now's your time. If it's, wait, I wanted to know, give us a second and get our canned stuff out, and then we'll get to you, okay? Otherwise, we'll never get to all we're supposed to say, and then we get in trouble.
I just had one comment, and that was if you go the trademark route.
Okay, I just had one comment, and that is if you go the trademark route, you'll have to pay for the filing, but about 5 years, I think, you have to refresh.
Yes.
And so you'll have to pay some money again.
Yes.
And there are maintenance fees with patents if you get a utility patent, but...
The government will find ways to make you pay more money. And once you file your patent or you file your trademark and are awarded it, you'll have to pay your renewals. Copyright, one fee, and you're done.
And then you get it for your entire life plus 70 years after you're dead.
Yes. So your heirs are set.
Live a long life.
Live a long life. Your copyright lives with you. If you want, you can do a joint work. In a joint work, you get life plus 70 of the last to die. So, put your kid on your copyright. And
find a newborn baby. Co-author
a book.
And
that person was your joint. At least make them able to speak, so there's some credibility there. But if you have a joint work, it's the last to die. So just don't get into a fight and kill each other, because then you've only got 70 years from that day.
Sell it to Disney like, and they'll keep it alive forever for you.
This is like
don't kill the author. Well, actually, that's a really good rule anyway. Whether it's relevant to copyright or not, don't kill the author. I like that as a basic rule.
Unless you really like the public domain.
Still anyway. 70 years off. No one plans that far in advance.
You might die after you kill one before you.
He'll die 70 years from now anyway. The old rule of copyright, you had to file before you published, and you had to renew your copyright. There were lots of formalities. There were lots of cases about, wait, I gave a copy of this to six people. Was that publication? There was all sorts of formalities. We no longer do those. But if you're trying to decide if a work is in the public domain, it can be tricky because a lot of times we don't know. Anything after 78 is pretty easy. No, it's not in the public domain. Anything before 70, between 1920, what is it, two? What's the
two? I
dropped out. I think it's 1922. Anything before 1922 is in the public domain. Anything between 1922 and 1978, it depends, which is my favorite legal answer ever, and it's always correct. But it depends on whether the author filed their renewal filing and things like that, and whether they filed an initial filing, whether they filed a renewal filing, and we don't know. If you do a work for your employer, if it's something that's part of your job, your employer's going to own it, not you. If it's something that you're contracted to do for the employer, get it in writing. A work made for hire basically means the employer is the author. The author is the one who owns the work. If you give the rights to your work to someone else, either an employer or a movie studio or whoever, 35 years later, you can take it back. It's a neat little quirk about copyright. This is why people care a lot whether it's a work made for hire or whether it's their work. If it's your boss's work, you don't get it back in 35 years. May or may not matter. if it's something that you're creating that you care about, it would be good to establish ahead of time to make sure you know. If it's some, but the short version is shy of giving you a, you know, full law school textbook chapter. If it's something for your work that you're doing as part of your job, or you're doing it that, and it'll benefit your employer, even if you're being a real go-getter and doing an extra thing that'll be great for the next project, it's your boss's most likely. It belongs to the company, most likely. If it's something you care about that you want to do that's related to your job, but you want to own it and don't want the company to own it, that's a great time to talk to a lawyer before you start. Once you start, remember, it gets fixed. As soon as it's fixed in a tangible medium, even if not in its final form, then it exists and then it belongs to whoever created it. So if it's something that you're doing that's sort of like work, talk to a lawyer ahead of time to make sure you separate it out so you don't find out later that the company owns it.
Hang on.
If you volunteer and do it.
It depends. If it's something you care about, fine. It's gonna, there's a whole list of factors that we go through, and it depends. And again, if it's something that you really care about, that you think you really want to own the copyright for, talk to a lawyer ahead of time so they can work through your exact situation and they can give you exact advice rather than here's the vague categories. Trademark lasts forever, copyrights life of the author plus 70. If you, there are ways that you can put things into the public domain so people can use them. The Lawrence Lessig folks have a delightful set of online things you can download, and you can use the licenses there to give partial works, partial licenses, and things like that. They are, I usually will tell you, if you download a contract from the internet, you're going to get what you deserve and what you paid for. Even if you pay $10 for it, really, come on. We're lawyers. We don't do anything for $10. So if you're downloading form contracts off the internet, they're crap. Unless you're getting one of the ones from the Lessig folks, those are actually very good. They're user friendly. Creative Commons. Yes, thank you. Creative Commons folks, the Creative Commons licenses. Lawrence Lessig was the lead academic doing that, and he sadly is actually a really nice guy who practices what he preaches. I wanted to use a chunk of one of his books in a textbook I recently did, because his explanation of the Creative Commons and all that was much better than my paraphrasing of it. I'm like, I just want to use the whole bloody chapter, which is not a fair use. So I asked him, and I was thinking, come on, turn me down. This would be great, because he's always preaching about letting people use things freely, and I was going to have a great story if Lawrence Lessig told me to go pound sand or to pay him money. And sadly, within, 24 hours, this guy's famous and busy, and I'm nobody. Within 24 hours, he'd sent me a very gracious email saying, absolutely, use whatever you would like. It's perfectly free for you to use, even though it's in a textbook.
Lawrence Lessig.
So, sadly, he is not like an obnoxious hypocrite. He actually practices what he preaches, and his chapter is in my book. But, so the Creative Commons licenses are great if you want to share your work. I recommend them. I don't recommend anything else you can download. We're going to talk a little about some fan interface stuff, and then we will open to your questions, as I promised.
Yeah, so my name is Meredith Rose. I'm an attorney with a group called Public Knowledge. We're based in DC. We do a lot of telecom and intellectual property law. We just sort of are taking a breather from the net neutrality fight, which if you're interested in, you should come to the talk about this afternoon, 2:30. I'll be on that panel too. So I deal a lot with copyright and telecom sort of separately. First survey question. How many people in here have actively contributed to a fandom of some kind, either through fan art, fan fiction, podcasts, anything, cosplay counts? All right, we got a handful of hands. Okay, cool. Reading a fanzine, if you want to sort of go all the way back to print zines. So one of the things that I'm going to try and do is clarify what copyright is not. I do a lot of research on fan and communal ideas of intellectual property laws, and there are some community norms which people think are copyright, which are not copyright. They are in fact just purely social norms that these communities have developed.
The word for that is infringement.
What's that?
The word for that is infringement.
we could have a whole separate panel on that one.
That's different.
Things that copyright gives you as an author. So say I sat down and I wrote a book. I wrote a very famous book, and it had this huge fandom that sprung up, a la Harry Potter, and there were 7 books, and everyone was cosplaying, there were release parties, and people making art, and movies, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I sit back, and I'm resting on my laurels, and I think, what exactly am I allowed to do with my book? Things that my copyright in my book would give me. It would give me the right to print more copies of the book, or to authorize print copies of the book. This is assuming, by the way, that I haven't given away any of my copyrights to the publishing house. In the real world, when you write a book and you sign a publishing deal, you sign that copyright or portions of that copyright over to the publishing house. And therefore, it's like Random House or Scholastic, in the case of Harry Potter, gets to make a lot of these decisions and you sort of get consulted as an afterthought. But again, assuming I had self-published and managed to make all of this happen, I get to control the distribution of this book. I get to control how many copies of it are made. I get a right to control the translations of it. I get to approve any translations into foreign languages. I get to approve any derivative works, which is a big area with a lot of debate going on, what constitutes a derivative work and what does not. I get to control derivative works. Things I do not get to control. I do not get to control, if I sell a physical copy of the book, what the consumer does with that physical copy of the book when they own it. They can shred it. They can make it into an art project. They can sell it back to a bookstore. They can give it to a friend for free. I don't get any money out of that, period. That's a thing called the first sale doctrine. And the first sale doctrine essentially says, look, once you've sold this book, it's out of your hands. You don't get any further. You get 1 point of payment for it. That's the payment for the book. And then as the author, you wipe your hands and go home. You cannot control the aftermarket for these books. There is a movement right now in Europe. Europe's got its own very different, strange set of copyright laws. They have a different framework for looking at it than we do. But part of what there is a movement to get resale royalties, which is basically every time that book is sold, even after the first point of sale. So if I turned around, I sold my book, and I sold it to Roger. Roger read it, said, oh, this isn't for me. Turned around and sold it to Courtney. I would get a portion of the sale from my book to Roger, and under this new prescription, I would also get part of the money that he got from Courtney.
I'm not telling him.
Exactly. And like functionally, there's a lot of questions about how this is going to work. Public knowledge for the record, I mean, we're sort of with EFF, we're kind of like copy leftist in a lot of ways, and so, you know, we think we're pretty free flow of information, basically. And so, you know, this is just a terrible idea on a lot of levels. Things this does not give me control over. So to sort of sidestep here, I mentioned earlier that European copyright law has a very different system of how they think about things. In Europe, they don't think about copyright. Copyright, in the American term, is an economic right. It is my right as an artist to be compensated for the use of my work. And that continues on life plus 70 years. So after I croak, all my descendants for the next 70 years are going to be reaping all of the all of the royalties from this book. If it's a work for hire, it's a set, you know, if I do it for my boss and I publish it for my boss and it's a work for hire, it's a set number of years. I don't recall what that is. In Europe, it is viewed very much as a right of the artist. They're called moral rights. And it's a literally le droit d'auteur, which I can't pronounce French, so please no one correct me. I took Spanish in high school and Japanese in college, not French. But it's the rights of the author. And there, it's very focused on the moral rights of a creator. So one of the things that comes up quite a lot, and we saw this actually, one of the first things I ever did when dealing with intellectual property law when I was an intern at Public Knowledge many moons ago, was there was, in the lead up to the 2012 election, an instance where Sarah Palin, or it was John McCain, used Running on Empty in his, that was in 2008. There was something, there was an instance where
Sarah Palin used Barracuda.
Was it Barracuda?
Yeah, it was Barracuda.
Yeah, so this is a kind of thing that happens all the time, right? So a politician gets up, they use a song, all of a sudden the artist goes, you know, screw you, don't use my music, I don't want to be on your campaign. This happens all the time. Now, under American law, the way that copyright law for music, which is this whole separate beast and a really interesting one, if you're a nerd like me, music copyright has got its own kind of kooky structure, which I'm totally happy to talk about if anybody's interested. But the end point of these situations is 99% of the time, the candidates are legally totally in the clear. They have paid who they need to pay. The money has been distributed, presumably, in the way that needs to be distributed. They have totally signed off. They're in the clear. The artist, all they can do is stand up and get on their soapbox and say, I don't like it when you do that. Please stop. Don't do it again. I hate you. So, you know, there's a public backlash, but there's not really any, like, legal side effects of them doing this. In Europe, the concept of moral rights basically says that if someone does that, the author can stand up and say, no, and then they can't do it again. Legally, they cannot do it again. The author has, like, essentially it's a sort of system of total control to some extent over the work that the author produces. I'm not an expert on European copyright law, but I'm happy to talk about it if anyone's interested. Now, one of the things that I work a lot on, and I'm writing a book on, hopefully someday it will actually be finished, we'll see if this happens, is about fandoms and copyright and creative fan communities and the ways that they deal with copyright. So one of the things that fandoms like to think is involved in copyright, and it's mostly just a social norm, is a thing called the right of attribution, which is if you take someone, if anyone has ever been on Tumblr and followed enough artists, you see this come up all the time, because people repost art constantly. They will download the art file, it won't have a watermark on it in a lot of cases, they'll repost it on their own account with no attribution to the original artist, and this happens all the time, everywhere. I mean, it's all over the internet. Like, it's just completely endemic. Google Images is basically the number one facilitator of this problem all the time. And I love Google Images, but, you know, it's got its own set of problems. And so artists get understandably very upset about this and say, like, hey, who are you? This is my art. I spent hours and hours on this. In a lot of cases, it's, you know, it's fan art, so it's not something they're necessarily making a living off of. They're, like, a lot of them are graphic illustrators and work full-time doing other stuff. You know, but it's insulting. Someone took the stuff off my blog, like, they just, or they deleted my comments, which had the attribution link in it. Like, what the hell, man? In U.S. copyright law, there is no right of attribution. There is a right of distribution, which basically means, like, theoretically, they have the legal right to say, no, you don't get to do that. It gets a little wacky when you're dealing with online platforms. A lot of online platforms, when you sign up to use them, will have a little box that you tick saying, I've read the terms and conditions, which is a lie. None of us ever do. And inside,
even we don't, unless there's a reason that we want to use it in a class or something. We just check, I agree, like the rest of you do.
My life revolves around dealing with end user license agreements, and I almost never read them. I never read them unless I'm trying to find a reason to argue with them for my job.
Yeah.
I think the iTunes EULA at one point was someone pointed out it was like 30 pages long in like 10 point font. They're ridiculous.
The Microsoft one for a while, and I swear to God I'm not making it up, it's in a footnote of a very boring article I wrote, and I just needed filler, so I put a whole chunk of the EULA in there because, oh my God, honestly, when you used Word, they disclaimed any thermonuclear war that was caused by the software. It was in there.
It's in there.
And I have a history of
breaking
computers and software, and I was really afraid to type for a while, so there's a way to blow it up, I'll do it, and apparently they were disclaiming thermonuclear explosions, which made me think I might cause one, but there's all kinds of crap in the EULA.
But yeah, so when you sign up with these art sites, like Tumblr, or like this is a big deal with Facebook for a while, DeviantArt, sort of all these other major collaborative sites where there's a lot of creativity going on, when you sign up and you click that, yes, I agree to the EULA, part of what you're agreeing to is the fact that the website has the right to redistribute the contents of your blog for its own purposes, essentially. A lot of times this comes up in things like advertising, with things like Tumblr, where it's a sort of a peer-to-peer reblogging. It's like a, I don't know, I had a better way to describe this once. Tumblr is weird. If you haven't used it, it's just, it's like Pinterest, but with content. You just like take stuff from other people's blogs and you post it on your own, and then people take it from you and it accumulates notes, and a lot of people are 14 years old. So you know, there's only so much you can do because Tumblr is totally in the clear because you basically said, like, yes, you may redistribute the art that I am putting up. So yeah, it gets a little wacky. Right of distribution is a thing in American law, right of attribution is not. So like technically you if someone reposts your art, you don't have a right, unless you want to slap them with a copyright claim, which is where things get a little weird.
Ready for some questions?
Yeah, might as well.
Hi, I'm going to go back to Roger. He seems lonely up there now.
Okay.
I was wondering, this is maybe a bit outside of it, going back to trade secrets, what happens when like a health and safety issue meets a trade secret for a food, like Colonel's 11 herbs and spices? If they discover that oregano is causing listeria, but nobody knows what the 11 herbs and spices are, what happens when public health and safety or a public need meet a trade secret?
No, I'm not sure. Like, obviously, I don't do any work with the FDA or any of those people, so I don't know what their regulations are. But I know that you can submit information and have it kept secret within those organizations. I think there are provisions where it's almost like when sometimes people, when they have a lawsuit over trade secrets, they seal the record so that everybody can't just go look at it, because otherwise it defeats the purpose, right? I mean, a court case is open to the public for the most part. So if two people are battling out, that's why, going back to that Coke example, even though Coke could get the record sealed, they're not going to risk that. But now with some of the things dealing with some of the different government entities like that, a lot of, like with drugs, you don't have to worry about that because people file patent applications on drugs and they tell you how to make it, and the FDA, and they go through tremendous, you know, safety testing and whatnot. But if there were something like this, maybe they did have a secret on how they prepare the special sauce, then they may have to disclose that to somebody at the government, and then the government keeps that a secret for them. And if, for example, I'm a rogue agent at the FDA and I release, you know, the secret sauce for Kentucky Fried Chicken, that would be that can be considered, I personally, if I'm found out, I could end up going to jail. Trade secret theft can be something that you can go to jail for. There was an example, someone thought they were selling this secret formula for Coke to Pepsi, but they were really selling it to FBI agents, I think. So I think they went to jail for like 6 years. So in that sense, you can do that. The misappropriation of trade secrets, if I come about a trade secret through an improper method, I can be, there can be restraining orders and stuff like that to keep me from acting on it and keep me from using it. So if someone from the FDA were to leak out a secret that's not supposed to, then other people could be enjoined from using it anyway. So there are certain ways to protect that when you do have to, because you can't go to the government and say it's a trade secret. They'll laugh at you. I mean, that's not going to happen. So in that sense, you may have to turn over stuff to the government, but there are methods of protecting it within the government.
So I'm a first-year law student. I'm interested in...
Quit now.
I'm interested
in... It's going to get grim real fast.
Yeah.
I'm still in the honeymoon period where it's fun still. 3 weeks in. So I'm interested in copyright, but I have no background in it whatsoever. So is there anything in Atlanta that is a good resource or an organization or, you know, some sort of membership program or networking, like where I can learn more and sort of get more involved in educating myself that way?
I would give you two suggestions. One is the Georgia Lawyers for the Arts. They use student interns. You have to apply for that. But the Georgia Lawyers for the Arts is a local group that does pro bono work for artists. And a lot of lawyers volunteer for them. I don't think I have to disclose that I used to be on their board. But they do work for a lot of artists that can't afford to hire expensive lawyers. And they use student interns, and they have a library that's open for use. I mean, you're a law student, there's libraries. Go read NEMR, and that's all you'll ever need to know. It's a shelf of books. NEMR is the treatise. Read that. That's all you need to know. But you can also go to the IP section of the Georgia Bar. They have meetings sporadically, and there are ways just to sign up as a student member, and they'll invite you to the meet and greets and the CLEs and things like that, and you go in as, hi, I'm a student. Do you have a job for me? And some of them will be nice to you and some of them won't. But you can sign up as a student, as a member of the IP section of the Georgia Bar. Those would be the two easiest ways I can think of to kind of get your foot in the door. But like I said, if you just want to know more about copyright law, read.
Yeah, if you're interested more in like public current ongoing copyright debacles, because there's never a shortage of bizarre copyright debacles going on in the world.
Blurred lines.
Oh yeah, the blurred lines case, and just anyway, it's never ending. So definitely, I mean, I'm going to plug my own organization, Public Knowledge. We have a running blog and website and everything else. You know, again, split between tech policy and copyright. And EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Obviously say EFF is a great source of information. They have emails you can sign up for, get on their mailing list.
No, they're great. So yeah, definitely check them out.
What are the different types of patents, like utility, et cetera? And then is a provisional patent worth going through?
The there really is no such thing as a provisional patent. You can have a provisional patent application. And what that is really just kind of a placeholder in time. You see that a lot with, at least I see it a lot with professors. They're getting ready to go to a conference, so we file a provisional patent application for them because we don't have time to do a full-blown patent application for them. And what that does is it gets them something on file with the patent office, and then within a year, they need to file a utility patent application. You have a plant patent, or there are plant patents, design patents, and utility patents. Those are the three types. The provisional is just a type of application. A utility application is sometimes referred to as a non-provisional application. Basically, anything that's not a provisional application is a non-provisional application. But that non-provisional can be towards for something that's utility-based, design-based, or plant-based. The plant patents are what they sound like. It's for a plant. If you somehow splice together some genes and create the little Shop of Horrors plant, you could probably get a patent on that. If it's a naturally occurring foliage, you're not entitled to a patent on that. Design covers the way something looks. It has nothing to do with function. The claim for that, there's usually a single claim in a patent in a design application. Not usually, there is. And it covers the ornamental design of the whatever's in the figures. Like this bottle, you can get a design patent on the bottle. And more than likely, whoever makes Mountain Dew probably has one. So the design covers the way it looks. And the utility covers the actual function of the thing, how it works, it's the physical structure of it, if it's something mechanical, if it's software that, even software has structure. It's the structure of how the software works. So that's the different types that you have. And they have different requirements. Again, the filing fees are different. Utility patents have maintenance fees that are due at 3.5, 7.5, and 11.5 years, and they get progressively more expensive as you have to pay them. Design patents do not have they do not have maintenance fees. They're good from 14 years from the date of issuance, and that's just it. I don't know that much about plant patents because I've never done them. If you look in the manual of patent examining procedures, the part on plant patents, I think it's like 5 pages. It's very thin. There's not a lot of them filed in a year, maybe 10 or 15. Find a specialist on that. But with the utilities, again, you have the different maintenance fees that are due, the different requirements that are when you actually file the application in terms of claims, things like that. The filing fees are different for the different types of applications. So in that sense, I mean, there is a difference in the two. And depending upon what you're doing, maybe a design patent is the way to go. For the way it looks, and then you can also go for a utility on how it works. Sometimes you can do that. You have to be very careful doing that because you don't want to later somebody to say that your design patent is really over the function. That can get you in trouble because then it'll be invalid. It could potentially be invalid. So, I mean, that's kind of the general of the different types.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. I've been doing a little research online because I'm a creator, comic creator. And I came across a new thing that Congress is trying to push through that once you've created something, it's not automatically copywritten anymore, that you still have to go through, you still have to put it, send it over to the government and all of that and actually file every single thing.
That would be a substantial change to the existing Copyright Act. Obviously, Congress wrote the 76 Act. They could write a new one, but that would be a substantial change to the law. Doesn't mean they can't do it. I haven't heard of that. Have you?
I haven't heard anything like that. I know there's an ongoing, one of the things that we're dealing with right now is the TPP, which has got some intellectual property provisions in it. I don't think there's anything requiring the legal term for those are formalities, having to go through and register and like file with the government. I haven't heard anything about that.
To a certain extent, Congress would not be able to do, there are certain things they would not be able to do because of the Berne Convention, which is the International Convention for Copyright Law. And one of the big reasons we moved away from formalities, aside from the fact that it made sense to do so, but this is Congress, so made sense was not a good enough argument. We also moved away from them because we were required to under the Berne Convention, which we had signed. So we had to change our law to comply with Berne. And I don't know if automatic protection is part of Berne off the top of my head, but I know that a lot of the formalities are forbidden by the Berne Convention. So if Congress were to pass that, they would be changing the law to violate a treaty. And that would, they could, but they would
try.
Be unlikely to do so, would be my thought on that. And honestly, I just haven't heard about that. But
yeah,
that'd be a substantial change to the existing law and most likely would violate an existing treaty.
Yeah, I have two quick questions, hopefully. The first one being, when would you copyright the book? Do you have to wait until you've reached a publisher and you know that there's no final, you know, no more edits? Or is it as soon as you know that you're going to do it and you have a storyline? Or do you subsequently copyright again after you've made a final product, so to speak?
So one of the cool things is, so we were just talking about formalities and having to register. The opposite of that is a thing called common law right. And basically, we have our copyright system in the U.S. is a common law right, which means the moment you set pen to paper, that's copyrighted. So while you're still plotting it out in your head, that's not copyrightable. The notes you write while you're making the book, those are copyrightable, even though it's not the book. Basically, as soon as you actually start to write the book, as every time you put something, a word down, it's the copyright is just growing along with it. And so as soon as it's done, that's copyrighted. If you go through and edit it a few times, that's also copyrighted. But presumably you're not completely rewriting the whole book. But
when you get to the point that, I mean, as you said, as you write it, it's fixed and tangible medium under the statute, it's covered. As I said at the beginning, if it's something you care about, when you get to the point that you're, and from a practical standpoint, when you get to the point where you're thinking of showing it out to publishers or whatever, maybe that's when you file it. Although, if you find a publisher, you're going to end up signing the copyright over to them. But it's better to have gone ahead and filed it at that point, would be my thought. You are protected once you've written it, and the form that you have written it in most recently counts. I wouldn't bother filing each intermediate step. When you get to what you think is about done, that's when I would say, you know, go ahead and spend the, $60 now and file that.
Are we doing any violations of trademarks by cosplaying? Because we haven't reached out to anybody, you know, and I had a costume made from a show, and I'm walking around and I'm thinking, am I infringing on something?
That's a long and complicated question, depends such that I'm writing a book about it.
If I represent Marvel, yeah.
Yeah.
If I represent it, you, no.
You can come up and ask me about that. I am happy to give a long answer about that afterwards. And the answer is, it's not entirely clear. It would be a copyright violation rather than a trademark, though.
Well, except when Marvel has trademarked some of their stuff as the...
Like, Captain America's shield is like a trademark, because it's just an iconic symbol. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's got trademarks. So if you're carrying around a cap shield, that might be a trademark infringement.
Yeah, you can...
It also might be a fair use.
All of it's copyright, some of it's trademarked.
If you're making money off of it, chances are higher that it's not a fair use. But yeah, this is a long cotton.
Fair use is a different panel. That, depending on who you ask, it is or isn't a fair use. And you don't really know until the judge tells you.
It's a sniff test.
And that was an expensive way to find out.
Yeah.
Basically, I know you guys had said earlier, as soon as you put pen to paper, et cetera, it's kind of already in the process of being copyrighted.
No, it is copyrighted.
It is copyrighted.
It is covered.
Right. So, again, does that then apply to works in progress? As you procedurally go through it, does it still stay copyrighted?
Yeah, whatever you've written is protected.
All right. And so, again, I know this is a redundant question to ask anyway. So, this does apply to anything, any physical medium, as long as it's not in your head. So, also digital would apply as well.
Digital
right.
counts.
Right.
As long as it's more than transitory. Computer doesn't count.
Yeah, if you don't save the Word doc, if you don't save the Word doc and then you close it and it is gone forever, that was not copyrighted.
When we erase stuff off the whiteboard, that was not, you know, we can argue whether that was tangible long enough, but, you know, if once you've saved the document, that's fine. It doesn't have to be hard copy.
What if you take a photo of it?
That counts.
The photo's copyrighted then.
Whoever
not necessarily
took
the text,
picture,
but the photo is.
Whoever took the picture actually pressed the button on the camera owns the copyright to the picture, though.
To the picture, but not necessarily of the text.
Exactly, yeah. So
that's an exam question. We like to give those to students.
And now we're getting down the 2L rabbit hole of the copyright class.
And what happens if a monkey presses the button on the camera?
Oh, we wrote about that at length.
Represent the researcher or everyone who's already spread his picture around.
Exactly.
My students wrote a memo on that last
The monkey
week.
Has the copyright.
Sadly, the copyright office says no. They put monkeys with pictures in their recent procedure manual.
Monkey with a selfie.
The interesting question is the distinction between the monkey with the selfie and the elephant with the paintbrush. I kid you not, my students.
I'm all for animal creative rights.
And I've got this guy here because he's...
derivative works like riff tracks. Are you guys familiar with those?
Oh yeah, I love riff tracks.
How is that protected, and then how do they have protection?
So
they're in the middle.
Right, so riff tracks is actually kind of cool as a case study. So for those of you who aren't familiar with riff tracks, if you have ever seen Mystery Science Theater 3000, it's the same guys who did MST3K, except instead of actually having the movie in front of them, they just record their commentary. And then it plays, like, they have a robot that recites occasionally a line from the movie, and you sync it up while you're watching the movie on your TV, which is a absolutely brilliant end run around copyright issues, by the way. Yeah, I think
like
this
that.
Is glorious.
It's a long one.
That's
so
clever.
They have a lot of time on their hands. Yeah, so they have their riff tracks are copyrighted. It's fine. And that is not actually, you could take it into court and argue that that's a derivative work, that it would need this original movie. Like, you can't just listen to a riff track on its own without the movie.
You can.
You can, but it doesn't have the same value to
it. But it wouldn't be there if the movie didn't exist, so it's a derivative work.
Well, no, though. That's not, because if that was the test for derivative works, then, like, everything would be a derivative work. I mean, at that point, like, you couldn't have, I don't know, the entire DC Marvel comic wars. Like, I'm just gonna take a side here. DC did everything first, and then Marvel came in and did a lot of it second.
No.
And better.
I can't have Christmas without Coke.
It's fighting.
I'm gonna get shanked on the way out of this con. This is why I'm glad it's a small panel.
Now see, on Dragon Con TV, this one said, "Don't start religious fights like that."
There you go. I'm a Marvel. I will be cosplaying as She-Hulk tomorrow. I'm 6 feet. I've got to use it for something. And a lawyer. But yeah, there's an art. The category of derivative works, this is one of those things, it's like fair use. It's ultimately, the way the law is written, it boils down to it's a sniff test. And it's a sniff test in front of a judge. You really don't want to be stuck arguing either of these, because that means you're paying money to go into court. And there's a lot of academic debate around this, and should we make fair use of what they call a rebuttable presumption, which is means we just assume that it's fair use and it's up to the copyright holders to prove otherwise. You know, there's debate about that. Riff tracks is actually kind of wonderful and brilliant, and I adore them for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that it would be such an uphill fight to argue that that was a derivative work that they'd have to pay the movie studios for.
I don't think so. I usually sign with the content holders. That's my spin. But even I would say that the riff track is not a derivative work. That's an independent work. Inspired by, but not.
This is the last question.
I'll be here afterwards. If anyone's got any specific questions, you can just come up.
All right, so what if I already copyrighted a story, but I never copyrighted the characters? Are the characters in that work already copywritten? Or do I have to copyright them separately afterwards?
So this is actually, character copyright, so I don't think you cannot individually copyright a character. This is an ongoing thing in the courts right now, is whether or not a character in and of itself, like, taken out of the work, can be copyrighted. One of the really old cases about this had to do with Sam Spade, the detective. I think this was back in the 30s when someone wanted to do a Sam Spade movie and didn't get the permission of the original screenwriter. There's another one about Rocky Balboa where someone tried to write a new Rocky sequel that was not Sylvester Stallone, and they took him to court over it.
They lost. Rocky
and they won. Lost. So there's different tests that the court will use. One of them is, like, is this character sufficiently delineated to exist outside of, like, if I took Harry Potter out of the Harry Potter series, will we still know who he is? Like, is Harry Potter enough of an iconic character that we can, with especially Harry Potter from the books, Harry Potter doesn't have a visual representation. Mickey Mouse, there's a shape to Mickey Mouse. We know what Mickey Mouse looks like. We know him when we see him. He's copyrighted as an image. As a concept of a character, that's a whole, there's a million balls in the air. And so you couldn't file for copyright of a character, like, as a practical matter. You couldn't say, like, here is my description of, I don't know, my Harry Potter character. And you can't mail in your OC to the copyright office and get it copyrighted.
As a virtue of your book being copywritten, however, the characters in your books have protection to the extent they are, as you're saying, sufficiently delineated. If you have a stock character, you know, star-crossed lovers, Irish cop, a lot of those come from the classic cases, those things, no. So Harry Potter, an orphaned boy being raised in unpleasant circumstances who discovers he's king. I mean, magic. I mean, you know, there's a trope there. And at some point you go past the classic fantasy category of young boy who's someone he thinks he's not and saves the world. And at some point it becomes Harry Potter. When you can identify it as Harry Potter, you're violating the copyright. If you're coming up with a young boy who suddenly discovers he's magic, you've now discovered half the fantasy books ever written, so you're okay.
Yeah, I will say really quick, because I know we're running out of time, one of the great cases that deals with this is about the character Spawn. And it was, the case was written in the early aughts by Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit, who, if anyone's familiar with Judge Posner had a copy of the comic book of Spawn. I went to UChicago Law School, and I actually got to talk to him about this. Cool. He kept the copy of Spawn, which involves a woman in chainmail bikini. And this guy's like in his 70s by now. He's just this like old guy at a desk. He's a judge on the Seventh Circuit.
He's brilliant.
He's hilarious.
Though.
And he keeps this thing front and center. This like ginormo woman in a bikini with an axe is just like on his desk in the Seventh Circuit.
I'm fairly certain it's because he has an excuse to now.
Yeah. No question. That's one of the great cases.
I like that one.
Okay, we have to wrap it up.
All right, cool.
Ta-da!
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.